Welcome to the show. I'm James.
I'm David.
I'm Riley.
And today we're discussing Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. We'll laugh, we'll argue, we might get a little too into it, but at the end of the day, dear boy, they're just movies.
Spoiler alert.
What in the world?
You can hear Jim Carrey's Canadian accent in this film a couple of times.
I can hear Kate Winslet's British accent a couple times.
I couldn't hear either.
And you're the expert.
Maybe I just wasn't paying attention.
Give me another spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
And by the way, next week,
three times.
Train to Busan. It's a Halloween episode.
Train to Busan.
Busan.
Poisson.
Is this like a bussy?
It's a fishing trip, but on a train.
Oh, boy.
How does it work?
David, give me your rating for this movie, Eternal Sunshine, out of 10.
Eternal Sunshine won't ever be wiped from my memory.
Nice.
Because you really
that's all
love
you need.
9.5 out of 10. This is my favorite movie of all time.
Really?
I can see that it's not perfect. There's no such thing as a perfect movie, but this balances so many elements in just the right way. It's approachable on its first watch and you get a lot of it, but there's so many moving elements. There's so much to think about, and it's the kind of movie when you finish, you kind of just want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're going to do
today.
That's
why we're here.
That's Riley. This is a podcast. This is an emotional, innovative, technically and structurally complex work, and it's a terrific accomplishment in the filmic arts. I hate it.
Pretentious.
I give it an 8 out of 10, because it's objectively a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
You actually didn't enjoy it?
No, I did enjoy it. I did. That's a joke.
Okay.
I don't hate it.
Our resident hater, Riley.
It bothers me for many reasons, which we'll get into. Why.
Good. There had to be someone here. Keep the conversation going. Imagine Inception was a rom-com. Then take out most of the calm and sprinkle back in a dash of disgust for each person involved in the rom.
Hey.
This movie rules. 9.5 out of 10.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
You both gave it 9.5?
Yeah.
We didn't include either.
Oh, no. Our spectrum of opinion is so tiny.
8 to 9.5.
That's really shifted the Overton window here.
We knew we were going to like it. Well, I knew that I was going to like it.
Nice reference.
Thank you.
I watched this movie when I was like 15 in the theater.
In the theater?
Yeah, like I saw it when it came out. I think it was the type of movie I wanted to like. I know I wanted people to know that I liked it.
Yeah.
I listened to Death Cab for Cutie.
Oh, sure. Know? Yeah, yeah.
But I definitely didn't really get it.
Yeah.
This time I did. I loved it.
I don't think I've ever actually seen it all the way through.
Hmm.
I feel like I saw clips of it, maybe. I definitely have seen a big chunk of this movie. I don't remember sitting down and watching the whole thing through. I definitely have.
That's great, Riley. Thanks to Athletic Greens for sponsoring today's video. Each scoop of Athletic Greens AG1 has 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens to help you start your day healthily. You know that? You're supposed to say healthily most times?
I forgot about that.
It's got less than 1 gram of sugar and no nasty chemicals or artificial additives while still tasting great. Each pack costs you less than $3 a day. It's time to reclaim your health, dang it, and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. Eat like crap and then eat this. Mm. And you're G to G. Just one scoop and a cup of water every day. No need for different pills and supplements to look out for your health. Gout. I don't know, it just rhymed with out. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free 1-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you got to do is go to athleticgreens.com/TJM.
Okay. Will do.
Thanks to Manscaped for sponsoring today's episode. Manscaped's Lawnmower 4.0 is designed to keep your family jewels safe with their ceramic blades featuring skin-safe tech to reduce nicks and cuts and bloody balls. Leave the cables at home with its new wireless charging system that's compatible with most Qi charging pads. It's cordless. It's waterproof. It gets 90 minutes on a full charge. Head to manscaped.com/TJM20 and get 20% off and free shipping.
What?
Outrageous. Thanks to Vessi Footwear for sponsoring today's show. I'm wearing a pair right now.
Me too.
They're known for being lightweight, easy to pack, comfortable, and most importantly, water resistance with their Dymatex technology. I'd buy that for $1. Their Everyday Move line is designed with added support at the midsole, the most important part of the sole, really, and better breathability to keep up with your active lifestyle. Take them off and put them on with these thanks to their handy pull tabs. They're slip-ons, y'all. I live and die by slip-ons. No laces for me. Also, they're made cruelty-free, so every step you take will be guilt-free. You're walking on sunshine. Your feet will thank you. Say goodbye to wet socks and check out Vessi at Vessi.com/TJM and use the code, you guessed it, TJM.
What does that even stand for?
They're just movies, man. Teenage Jiu-Jitsu Ninja Turtles.
Men. Teenage Jiu-Jitsu Men.
Ninja Turtles. It's off. No. It's cursed. All right, Riley, did you write a synopsis?
I did. Here's what happens.
What happened?
It's a little confusing.
Okay.
But it's quicker. After a fight, introvert Joel discovers that his super extroverted girlfriend Clementine has had her memories of him erased by a company called Lacuna. So he decides to undergo the same procedure, which involves recounting their volatile relationship on tape. Lacuna employees Stan and Patrick perform the procedure while Joel sleeps in his apartment so he doesn't remember it. Joel re-experiences his memories of Clem as they're erased, but is confused to hear Patrick talking about Clem in the real world. Midway through the operation, Patrick leaves, and we see that he has been using Joel and Clem's memories as a guide for seducing Clem. Lacuna receptionist Mary arrives at Joel's apartment and has sex with Stan. Meanwhile, as Joel reaches earlier, happier memories, he realizes he doesn't want to forget and attempts to hide in unrelated memories with his mental projection of Clem. Confused, Stan calls his boss Howard, who takes over for Stan. Joel comes to his last remaining memory of Clem, the day they first met on a beach in Montauk. As the memory crumbles, Clem tells Joel to meet her in Montauk. In Joel's apartment, Mary tells Howard she loves him and they kiss, but they're seen by Howard's wife. Furious, she tells Howard to tell Mary the truth. Mary and Howard previously had had an affair, and Mary had her memories erased. In the morning, disgusted, Mary mails Lacuna's records to the patients. Joel wakes up, his memories of Clem erased, and impulsively goes to Montauk, meeting Clem on the train home. They are drawn to each other and go on a date to the frozen Charles River in Boston. Back home, they both receive their Lacuna records and tapes, and they're shocked by their bitter memories and almost leave each other, but they agree to try again.
Lacuna Matata, baby.
Maybe it'll work this time. And that's the end of the movie. I was screaming.
One of the coolest parts of this movie is that the beginning isn't the beginning.
Yep.
Yes.
And but you don't have to wait to your second viewing of the movie to realize that. After it's like half an hour in, you're like, oh, I thought that was their first meeting, but it's not.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's great because there's like two little sub questions that you have. That you're like, what? And then once you find out that fact, you're like, oh,
yeah.
Like including like his car being busted.
Oh yeah.
You're like,
yeah.
Okay, I think what I'm watching now happened after what I just saw. Or happened before what I just saw, but his car is still broken, so that can't be. Yeah. And then it all kind of comes into place and makes you feel like a genius.
Yep.
Yeah, I think I wrote down in my notes, wait, when did they meet? Like a minute before it's like three quarters of the way through the movie or something. And it's like, oh, I get it. Although, as I was watching this, as I was writing the synopsis, I realized that I think there might be like a time paradox thing going on.
That?
So, is it implied that they went to the frozen river twice?
What do you mean?
Because so Patrick is using their memories and their keepsakes and stuff to try and seduce Clem.
So he
one of those things that he uses is a memory of them going to the frozen river and him lying down and saying, "Oh, I've never been this happy" or whatever.
Yeah.
And that happens, and then they get their memory, and then Joel has his memory erased. Then they meet again in Montauk, and then they go to the river.
They
and
do that same thing.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
It again.
They just do the same thing twice.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
But actually, I do have a bit of a nitpick. I think there is a continuity error there where because when they meet for the second time after being wiped, it's the first time we see it at the beginning of the movie. The whole thing is he keeps describing her as nice and saying nice, and it becomes like a little meme between them, right?
Yeah.
And then we see the Elijah Wood character. What's his name? Patrick?
Patrick.
Patrick. He's so perfectly creepy in this movie. He's living through the notes, and he says nice to her, and she goes nice and like freaks out. I mean, that's right before, like, she's already been wiped, and that's just another thing that triggers her, because he's kind of like bringing back all these memories that he wiped from her the week before.
Yeah.
And he says nice, she freaks out about it, but the nice thing was a meme from a date that hasn't happened yet. It's from the second meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So why would that trigger her?
Well, I think it's just because it's like finding parts of her brain that are missing, and she's feeling really discombobulated, and she's like panicking because there's like just parts of her brain, her memories that are just gone. So it's reaching into the darkness.
I guess maybe the movie is just implying that both times they met, they said and did a lot of the same things.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's kind of like a theme in this movie is that like you kind of just are who you are. You're drawn to who you're drawn to. You love who you love.
Yeah. And the end of the movie really makes that clear, that they're just going to keep doing things the same way.
And
I guess
it's such a bleak ending.
Yeah, they
which
like
is weird.
They're playing with each other as the camera stays in the same place, and they're going down the beach in the snow, and like it repeats the same thing like three times.
Yeah, implying
or more,
implying that they do it a bunch, which is corroborated by the original script. Apparently, the original script was set 50 years in the future,
What?
It's like the framing device is Mary writing a memoir about Lacuna, trying to expose it. But then it's revealed that Clementine's had her memory of Joel erased 15 times.
Mm.
And so there's like definitely, I think that's the implication of the ending, and it's bleak.
Jeez Louise.
I think that is one of the most interesting questions of the whole film, is just what would you do kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in that situation, do you engage a relationship again? I think it's pretty human nature-y to say, yeah, they do, because the attraction's there and people kind of just generally like to just screw it. Like, just try. We'll do it differently this time.
Yeah. But like, it's, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But if they are going to engage, here's my question for you folks.
Oh, it's Charlie Kaufman. I actually intentionally didn't see who it is, but that makes sense. Go ahead.
Sorry. The writer, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. This movie is really like, I've been thinking of anything except like a good version.
Well, I think it's kind of nails the balance of really cerebral, but also having the kind of quirky heart part of it. I find Charlie Kaufman stuff can be so overbearing and challenging.
I think that's the team effort aspect. Like, yeah, there's parts of the comedy or the tone of this movie that Jim Carrey brought to it.
Yeah.
Then there's the director, and then Kaufman's just a screenwriter, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas like I've been thinking of anything is. Oh, here's a bunch of Netflix money.
He had full control.
Well, same with Synecdoche
in New York.
Synecdoche, New York. I hate that movie.
But anyways.
I derailed you, yeah.
I'm back on the rails here. Right. Question is, if you decide, okay, we know it ended poorly before, but we're going to try it again. Mm. Would you, or do you think it's ethical? Like, what is the right answer for, do you listen to the tapes before you engage in this second?
Of course you do.
Go?
And then you decide, oh, this is why we broke up. Let's stay broken up.
But so I feel like you would hear the tapes and you would feel so disconnected from them. It's like your emotional brain and your logical brain would be so separate, and you'd be like, well, like, man, better to have loved and love lost than to like never have loved at all.
Oh, I totally get why they got back together.
Mm-hmm.
But it's stupid.
But if you listen to the tapes, there's gonna be certain like self-fulfilling prophecies too, right?
Mm.
It's like I'm being made aware of a thing that will bug me that doesn't bug me yet, and then when thing occurs, you'll be like, oh yeah, that's what I was talking about. Ooh, I don't
there
like
there is
that.
There, yeah. Like, yeah, and I think I was looking for some sort of like, I think I would have liked the ending better if there was some sort of promise on their parts to like, okay, we're gonna watch out for these things, you know, we're gonna do it better because now we know these things up front, instead of like going through a relationship and going through all that friction as you discover all these things about the other person that really rub you the wrong way and make you go insane. We're going to know about that up front, and so we have a better chance. But it didn't really imply that. It did have a very fatalistic, as you say, David, like it was like kind of a pessimistic take on the whole thing, where it's like, yeah, you're going to hate each other and you're going to feel trapped and blah, blah, blah. And he says, okay. He's like, okay, okay.
But I think the movie is taking the stance that, yes, it's going to be shitty, and at the end you're going to have all this baggage, but it is worth it. For me, the movie takes such a turn as soon as Joel gets through the really shitty, almost breakup memories, and he gets to the one where Clementine's telling about how she used to yell at the doll, be like, be pretty.
Yeah.
And then he's like, I want to remember this one. He starts like crawling out of the blankets.
Yeah.
That's when the movie takes a turn and you're like, oh, there is something you want to hold on to.
The movie for sure is expert in that, where you're like, there's scenes where you're, God damn it, I can't wait for them to break up. They're so bad for each other. This is awful. I hate them both, actually.
Yeah.
And then there's other scenes where you're just like, they're meant to be together, yeah. Damn it, I love them.
For sure.
And the movie is so honest and they're so vulnerable, and you feel like you know the character so deeply. Yeah. It's so awesome at that.
Yeah.
So, do you listen to the tapes with your partner or individually? Because in the movie, they kind of just listen to them on their own.
You listen to it with them, and if you can handle it, then, all right, you can try and give it another go.
What do you think?
It's tough. I feel like it'd be so hard to hear the tapes about yourself, because it would be your deepest insecurities told by this person that you're attracted to, and it'd be really, I think it'd just be so hard.
I think if you could do it, though, that would be really next level.
Like, oh, for sure.
The amount of, there's no greater transparency than that.
Of course.
It's insane.
I mean, this is like, this type of stuff that they're saying on the tapes are, sometimes couples don't say that kind of thing to each other until things get really hard and they have to go to therapy, and then like they lay it all out. It's like you're getting a cheat code right at the beginning of the relationship. Like, this is all the shit that's going to hit the fan.
Well, and you can
stop it from hitting the fan.
The movie demonstrates that Joel is willing in the darkest times to throw that in her face. Like, he taught when she comes back drunk and he's like, oh, I just assume you were fucking someone because that's the only way you can get someone to like you.
Yeah.
It's like, he talks about that on the tape too. So it's like, all that stuff will come out. So I feel like the movie would take the stance of like, yeah, you should listen to
it. It's so interesting too, because when she hears that on the tape, she goes, I don't know why you say that, because I don't do that. And if she genuinely means that and it's true, then what that means is that he's projecting that.
Mm-hmm.
So why does he, is it because of the way they met that he perceives her to do that, or is that his own insecurity? So it's so interesting. There's so many layers it that you would have to be, just sit down and have a full like hour plus conversation before you play the tapes. Just being like, look, there's going to be stupid shit in there about people's grammar and how they pronounce library. But those things don't matter.
Yeah.
They're annoying. Yeah. But they don't matter because we love each other and that's why we're even doing this at all. So when those things pop up, try to like, let's try to move past those things as adults. And then the deeper things, let's really examine them and see if we can actually do this.
This is the other tough thing about this hypothetical, though, is that at this point, at the point when they're hearing the tapes and like learning all of this stuff, they've only known each other for
a day,
not even. Like they're not committed to each other. They don't love each other. You know? They only just met.
That's a great point.
So it's like, of course you probably won't have the endurance to sit down and like listen to this whole thing. Like, but
with that in mind, I think they should date for a couple weeks first. If they get to like the 1 month or 3 month mark, then they should listen to the tape.
I mean, did the movie say how long they've been together? It doesn't really matter.
A couple years.
Okay. Yeah. I mean,
you thought it was a couple years.
I think so.
Probably. I mean, it showed them like being pretty like embedded.
Different seasons.
With each other.
Lots of memorabilia.
Yeah, if you know that you were in a long-term relationship with this person, maybe that would add another level of like, okay, it's not like I just met you. Now I'm learning all this stuff and we have a history. It's almost like meeting a long-lost family member. Even though you don't know who each other, who you are, you can kind of like feel that connection and like...
Yeah, and the movie, kind of one of the main themes is that they can feel that connection they have. There's other elements just bringing them together.
Yeah.
Man.
I love that scene, even like on the train before when they're becoming reacquainted, how she's just like pushing into him, and even like the way they shoot it, where she's on the other side of the train and then all of a sudden she's like two rows ahead and then one row and then the same bench, and they're just pushing closer and closer into these close-ups. And by the end of that scene, they're like really almost kissing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, there's like something magnetic about their relationship that keeps drawing them together. Fascinating.
Yeah. And it's also interesting that the Joel that we get in that scene, he is different than the one that she met. Like, he's a kind of a depressive person. When they do meet on the beach, he's sitting on his own, but it's not the same as when they meet on the train, because he is grieving. Like, he's really sad. He's going through a breakup, which is different than he's living in a loveless relationship with this Naomi woman or something.
But is he grieving
because she broke up with him in an awful way, and he interacted with her where she, from his point of view, just gave him the cold shoulder and pretend he didn't exist, and he's just like so torn up about that.
No, but on the train, he's had her erase at that point.
He's had her erase, but his body still has all that.
Oh, I see. All the grief.
Because he wakes up in a weird funk, right? Yeah. Like, when he wakes up, which is the first shot in the movie, you could tell he like wakes up with some kind of like gravity. You know, he's like looking around, he's like, ugh.
Yeah.
And then he's like, I don't know why, but today I just felt... and I went this way, and he's writing his like really morose journal.
Yeah.
And the other part about him choosing to go on that train is he says, I'm not an impulsive person, but the time that he has spent with her is like, she is an impulsive person. She has changed him. So even after she's erased, he's still a different person.
Yeah.
Having been with her.
Maybe that could be true. I hadn't thought of that. I just thought that he kind of like had this sudden impulse to go because her whispering, his mental projection whispering to him, meet me in Montauk.
Yeah, he planted that seed.
It made him just kind of like, I should go to Montauk. It was like a subconscious thing instead of like a character change.
But I think both can be true.
And that's the link to the movie Inception right there.
Right there.
Inceptioned himself.
This movie is just basically Inception, but like
less blonde
high school drama version.
I don't feel like it's high school drama. High school. I feel like
they are emotionally unintelligent.
Are they meant to have a age gap between them? He seems like he's 5 years older.
Maybe a little bit, but I think it's like dating in your late 20s, early 30s. It's not like, it's all kind of nebulous.
She seems like 24, 25, maybe 26 to me. And he seems like 33, 35-ish to me.
Maybe.
He does say, I saw her with a much younger man.
Yeah, I think they're supposed to be like 30-ish.
Okay.
I just wondered if that was... Like, do you guys think there's an age disparity, or that they were meant to be the same age?
Although maybe... how old was Jim Carrey at this time? I don't know. I mean, he's been doing a bunch of stuff. He's at least 30 here.
Late 30s, I would
and
guess.
And Kate Winslet, I mean, she seemed like she could be late 20s or mid-20s, but I don't know.
Maybe she's just wacky. It's the
blue
hair.
they're adults, and they got stuff going on.
I love the way that they play against each other. I think, like, it's not an uncommon thing in movies to have, like, these opposites. Like the introverted man and the kind of extroverted, the manic pixie dream girl or whatever.
Yeah.
But they handle it deftly, and I think they handle it in a way that never feels like cliche.
Well, I think the difference is they're opposites, but they're simultaneously so similar to each other.
Mm.
But they're opposites in other ways.
How are they similar to each other?
I don't know. Like they're... I don't want to say outlook on the world, but just like their place in the world, or like they're in the way that they need someone.
I think they're really similar in the fact that they act like high school children.
You're so high-minded.
I really am, and it's annoying. I'm sorry. But like,
I really am, and it's a curse.
When I watch movies like these, I'm just so frustrated to see characters, both characters, like getting into a relationship, and I can tell right from the get-go, I'm like, not a good idea.
Would you say that you think most people are emotionally intelligent in the way that they can enter a relationship logically and make the right decisions?
No,
or do you think
of
most
course
people...
not. But this is like, you know, we've talked about this before. This is my lens that I like, I can't help but watch these movies through. Like, it's a descriptive movie rather than a prescriptive movie. But I think that's what bothered me about it on a deeper level, is that, you know, it's fine for this not to be my cup of tea. Sometimes I have no choice but to, I give it an 8 because I have no choice but to recognize the deftness and skill that was put into this. Like it's a great movie, but despite like, regardless of my lens that I watch it through, I was like willing to kind of give it the benefit, like just kind of turn that part of my brain off and be like, okay, I'm just going to experience this as is. It's descriptive. But then at the end, they get back together. And I'm like, I guess that could still be descriptive. I think I was just hoping for like at the end there, it's just like, okay, let's really cinch this. They like maybe say, let's take it slow or something, you know, like, hey, let's just go for coffee and like talk about it or something. But they seem to just kind of go headlong into.
Yeah, but that makes so much
into
sense.
It one more time.
That
and
makes
the
so
end,
much sense that they would, though.
It's true. It just bothers me.
I think the movie really succeeds as a subjective film. Like it really feels like you're seeing things through the eyes of a human being.
Yeah.
And I think that it's a great strength of it to manage to be so surreal and like POV, but also still remain grounded in a way where you can still connect to our world. And it never feels discombobulating in a way that's just like like hard to follow.
Yeah. I mean, it did make me ask a question because I was feeling this like sort of like, oh, this is a bad idea, guys. But then as they were kind of going on the dates and stuff, which all takes place in the prologue, basically. Like the title sequence starts at 18 minutes.
It's pretty late.
So we get all of these scenes of them like kind of meeting each other, getting together and stuff. And 18 minutes later, the movie quote unquote starts. It's like, whoa. But anyways, I was thinking that like, okay, wait, maybe. So he's obviously kind of like depressed or has issues with anxiety and all these things. And she also feels anxiety, but her anxiety is that she is not going to be making use of her time well enough, which is funny because they just like took a scene to like have them both describe their core character qualities. Well, like he's having a drink in her apartment and he's like, I'm just not that interesting. And she's like, I do everything all the time because I'm anxious. And it's like, oh, thanks. Now I know. But I was thinking like, maybe
I think there's enough scenes where they just show instead of tell. That
Yeah, it's true.
You're allowed
true.
To
the rest of the
pull
movie
the record
is fine.
A little bit.
I was thinking that for a person who is experiencing depression like this, you know, encountering a Clem could have a positive effect on his mental health, and I think it does, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was just making me think about like, you know, how people get into relationships and how they're searching for qualities in their partner that they think can like fix deficits in them, mm-hmm. and whether that is realistic.
But I feel like that's the most human take on relationships is people always are looking for that person to complete them. They're
right.
Looking for, like, she has that line that she'll repeat where it's like I'm just a fucked up girl looking for my peace of mind. Don't come to me for yours or whatever.
Yeah,
which she says twice.
Yeah, which I think is like
to your earlier point about them repeating.
Yeah,
themselves.
Yeah, that's clearly a core value for her, because even though she's had her memory erased, it comes back, and I think that's
or that, she just says that to every guy.
Well, no, exactly. Yeah. But I think that that's an essential kind of piece of analyzing this movie, is that perspective of they're both looking for something in the other person to complete them. And when that's taken away, they have to go looking for it again. And they get caught in this cycle.
I almost think it's better, like, for relationship health, though. I almost feel like it's better for people to, like, I think that it's worse when people look for someone who will fix them.
That's the worst. That's the most toxic.
Yeah, or look for someone to fix, right? They're like, oh, I have these deficits. I'm sad. I want someone who is default happy, so then it'll bleed over to me, and that'll fix my happiness. Mm-hmm. I think that it's like, you know, that because with my relationship, Lauren has definitely changed things in me and helped me to realize things that I was doing that were bad, and vice versa with her. You know, I've like we
deodorant
each other.
For one. You guys don't know Riley used
I
to
didn't
steam.
Believe in it.
Smelly man.
I thought it was an evil corporation trying to poison me. no, I think that like you should pair up with somebody because you have like, you know, because you have fun with them, and it's that shouldn't be the primary goal.
Well,
to like fix your personality.
I mean, let's get into therapy, guys. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it.
I feel like that's the biggest mistake that we carry from pop culture romance is you complete me. You are the missing part from me. And it's like, absolutely not. You should be a complete person finding another complete person, and you are compatible and you work together and you are more than the sum of your parts.
Yeah, and your partner doesn't need to be all things, you know? You can have friends for that to fill in those other gaps, you know? Be like, oh, I really like this person, but they're not an artist. And you're like, well, just hang out with some artist friends then, you know,
that's always kind of cringe when people have these like rigid,
like a checklist.
That's a very young person dating thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not us. We're wise.
And we're under 6 feet.
I mean,
well, he's not right. Isn't he?
What?
No wonder he's
I'm
so high minded.
I'm 6'1", bitch.
We're manlets.
Let's talk about the style of this movie.
Yeah.
Cause that is definitely one of its strengths. This is an old movie. It's almost 20 years old now, but it does not feel old. It feels very fresh.
2004, hey?
2004.
So Kirsten Dunst was in Spider-Man 2, and then this.
Yeah, that's a pretty good transition. Mark Ruffalo hadn't been the Hulk yet.
Mm.
Yeah. And then Elizabethtown.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, what the fuck are you talking about?
I'm only saying that because I Googled Manic Pixie Dream Girl to find what the first one was, and it was like... It was coined after observing Kirsten Dunst's character in Elizabethtown in 2005.
Is that the one with
film critic Nathan Rabin coined it? Rabin? I don't know.
I didn't know it was such a.
Is that
term?
The one that was with that that guy from Scrubs? That everyone's compared to Garden State. Yeah,
it's Orlando Bloom.
Yeah, yeah, and everyone was like, "It's like Garden State."
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, it was. Yeah, it's.
Oh yeah, I know. Natalie Portman is Manic Pixie Dream Girl too.
Archetype.
I never saw either of those movies, but I worked at the theater when it was going on.
Northeast coast of America, sad times, indie music.
The Shins, probably.
Gray filters on the
But
film.
Those movies really feel of their time.
Yeah.
This one, I think, outside of some of the technology or whatever, it feels pretty timeless.
It's pretty good with the VFX, too.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them are simple, just like wipes and roto, and some of them... like something will get rotoed out and like vanish, but then they actually do a cut like half a second after it vanishes, so you don't even get time to scrutinize how well they pulled off the VFX part.
It really works
really well.
Totally. Well, they try to do as much practically as they could. Like the beach scene, I actually didn't know this until I was researching it for this, where they're like, I was like, how do they get the water into the house and stuff? They just built a house on the beach and like let the like where the tide would be, and they let the tide come in and filmed it. And I was like,
oh my gosh,
that's pretty cool.
Man, so there are some like that whole all of those little tricks they do are so cool. And I feel like I started trying to write some stuff down, but they were happening so quickly that I couldn't even write it down before like something else happened. It's so chaotic and so frenetic.
Yeah. I wrote down a couple because I love them. I think one of my favorite is when it's close to the end of his memories being erased and he's in the bookstore with Clem and the books are just kind of turning to white.
Around
them, like, and slowly in the background, they're just kind of fading to white. And by the end of the scene, the entire bookstore is just filled with white books.
Yeah.
And it's such a like good effect, and it's subtle until like the movie wants you to notice. And it's like, one of my favorite transitions is when he's in the bookstore early on and he's running, he's trying to get out of it, and the lights turn off behind him, and then he steps into the room that he's having.
Yeah, I wrote that down.
That's such a cool little transition. There's a ton of like whip pans that work really well.
And that actually goes back to the thing that I noticed in this movie was how they reveal the information to you. Like they get it more and more complex, where at first you're just watching what you think is real time. And then you're watching, like you watch memories. In this case, you're watching a flashback. And then you kind of learn that it's a memory. Yeah. And I guess all flashbacks are memories, but it's that you're watching it as a flashback. And because he walks back into that physical space where he's telling the story from, you're like, oh yeah, okay. Because you never know in a movie if you're like, when a cut happens, what's happening? What does that cut mean?
Yeah,
did we just move in place and time in someone's mind?
Right.
Yeah. And so it's just interesting as the movie goes on, you get more and more like kind of subversion of the rules.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, now it's a memory, but he is conscious in the memory. He's an active agent in the memory.
Yeah.
And then later on still, it's like, okay, he's in the memory and he's an active agent in the memory and so is she. She's conscious in the memory and she can change things too. And then now they're jumping from memory to memory. It just kind of gets more and more complex.
Yeah. And the movie is a good variety of stuff too, because there's that sequence when they're constantly running away from being erased or whatever. And there's like the constant fun stuff where when she leaves the apartment, he chases after on the street, he parks his car and he's walking back and forth on the block, and as it's going, there's a car at both ends and things are being wiped.
That scene is so cool.
And they do that for many, many scenes, and then they go back to the real world where it's grounded. It gives your brain a little chance to kind of reconnect with reality. And then when your brain is relaxed, you get to go back into the mind, more of the surreal.
Yeah, it's really just like a perfect
balance of both.
I really appreciated how the movie would kind of like give you these like bursts of just like blah, manic, crazy, like, dream logic. And then it would pull you back out in the real world. And you're like, okay, take a breath. Okay, are we ready? Okay, we're going back in.
It kind of reminds me of Everything Everywhere All at
Totally,
Once.
Totally.
Insofar as it being like, this was the best movie of the year that maybe not that many people saw. Like both these movies, actually I don't know how much money this one made,
probably not very much,
but a lot of people have heard of this movie.
It ended up winning an Oscar for best original screenplay, which I think is well deserved, but I think that it's a shame that it didn't get like awards for its visual storytelling.
Sure.
I think that is its greatest strength.
Yeah, definitely.
But they seem similar. And well, also I had a kind of a little epiphany. I was watching this, I was like, this is like a multiverse movie, but it's not. They're not different timelines. They're all just in his mind. And even the different versions of the people are all him. Like, there's memory Jim Carrey or memory Joel and like active real now Joel.
Yeah.
And there's also memory Clem. And then the active Clem is actually still Joel.
I know. I was
right. It's all him because it's in his brain.
And I was really thinking about that this time.
At certain points,
it's all inside his mind. So
what do you mean?
You're saying this whole movie is
No. Whenever they're in his mind.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
so, for example, when she's like, meet me in Montauk, it's like he's saying that to him.
She never
said that. But it does get weird because she does say the line, I feel like I'm disappearing.
When?
She says it when she's getting kind of freaked out about with Patrick, and she's starting to feel the effects of something's wrong because she's been wiped and it's all kind of making her feel.
I think that's more because Patrick is fucking everything up by reintroducing these memories that she has forgotten.
What a scuzzy dude.
I know, Elijah.
But also just so stupid.
I love that. I love that character so much. It's so funny.
I like how they did it where he's just like out of frame. Like you just don't see his face. And then the faces are obscured. They never say it, but it seems like they've actively edited him out. Like when they're going into Joel's mind, they're like, okay, he saw Patrick's face, he saw Howard's face, let's just like zip that out.
Well I think the movie early on, I think some of the impact of that scene is lessened because we're so hyper aware of Elijah Wood when he's around. So there's a shot in the bookstore when he goes to bring her the necklace, but she's had him erased, so she's like brutally doesn't remember him, but you can see Elijah Wood just for a second going for the kiss.
Yeah.
And I think when you watched it in 2004, you wouldn't be as like, oh, there's Elijah Wood. You'd be like, oh, that's just some random guy or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the reveal of it being Patrick is a bigger deal. But I think the whole journey is so fun. Like, even when he grabs him, like, can't turn his head. I think the joke, I don't know why I think it's so funny, when his memory's being erased and he's talking to Tom Wilkinson in the dream. And he's like, I can't remember why, but he's like, Patrick.
He's like, who is that guy? Oh, he works for us. What's his name? Oh, his name is... Patrick.
I don't know why it kills me. But I think the slow play of him is great. I wonder what you guys think. And I was kind of wondering that on this watch, what the purpose thematically of Patrick's character is. Because like clearly he serves a story purpose and we kind of like move through and it helps Clem kind of like confront these things and get her conflict to be able to get to Joel. And it helps identify to the audience that her and Joel are a better match than we first think.
Authentic love.
They're an authentic love. But outside of that, do you think he serves a bigger purpose, or do you think that it's kind of more contained into like a utility?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to think of like a purpose that he serves because, I mean, story-wise, obviously the purpose that he serves is to screw Clem up so that she
create a reason for her to be similarly schismed.
Yeah, exactly. But
there's also just. We like these characters more. We think their love is more deserved because it's authentic, because we see this example of inauthentic love next to it. So,
and I think it works, I guess, to because there's like this weird three-tier level of like respect for Elijah Wood up to Mark Ruffalo up to Tom Wilkins' character. What's his name?
Howard.
Where they're kind of like, they each have the thing that the other person wants, but Elijah Wood's kind of like used his gross power to grab it.
Well, but this is what's so funny. Go ahead.
No, because he just like looks up to something that Mark Ruffalo has, and Mark Ruffalo clearly looks down on him.
Right.
Which I think is a really fun scene as well.
I mean,
he's like, I have a girlfriend. Did I tell you I have a girlfriend? It's like,
uh-huh. I love his characterization as like a weirdo, like sort of a sex pervert loser. I don't know, because like, because it is a really dumb thing. Like, his plan is dumb.
Mm-hmm. He's like a teenager.
It's like, hey, these people broke up because they had a horribly toxic and volatile relationship. I'm going to do the same steps. Like, and maybe she'll fall in love with me. It's mm-hmm. like, it didn't work out. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that is so stupid.
You're not following a step-by-step process for success. It's failure.
But maybe that's, it helps to serve the, oh shit, I kind of lost it. Never mind. Sorry.
Yeah, he's just dumb. He knows that he's, you know, getting her to fall in love with him through made up cheating ways.
Yeah.
So, because wait, what does he even do? He doesn't have anything going for him in terms of like he alters her brain so that she's attracted to him or places a memory of him being awesome. He doesn't do anything like that. All he has is this person she really liked. This is what he said to get her to like him. Mm-hmm. So if I do that stuff, she'll like me.
Maybe this is what bothers me a little bit about this movie, other than the, you know, just the bad relationship advice thing or whatever, is the fact that like every character, there's no characters in here who are like, you're fundamentally,
they're all flawed.
Rooting.
It's for like them. The show Girls.
It's not about, but it's not like, obviously characters need to have flaws, but I think that like, there's a difference between being flawed and being just fucked up all the way. You know, like every character is fucked up all the way. And
I think that makes it a great movie, though, because I hate in a rom-com, especially, they do this all the time, like a McConaughey level rom-com where it's like they have a catastrophic breakdown that makes them break apart at the end of act two before they like eventually get back together. Mm-hmm. But that breakdown is always just a stupid
communication issue
where it's like, well, I saw your ex-girlfriend naked through your window. So you obviously got back together with her. It's like, no, I came home and she was already naked there, but I just can't say that to you because that would make the movie too easy. So it's like, worst. But I'm not actually a shitty person because we need the audience to love both members of this relationship by the end. But that's why this is awesome, because you're like, I don't want to date them.
Well, I think it's
like, to me, why it works is that it feels very authentic. Like, it doesn't feel like a heightened level of shitty. It feels like the toxicity that people that don't do therapy or that haven't done that self-examination carry within them.
Or got caught up in a really shitty argument. Like, it was 3 a.m. and your car is screwed up and you're waiting for your girlfriend to come home and she's drunk again. Like, I could see why he would get so shitty situation.
I guess what I'm looking for is like a middle ground between what you described, which is basically just like, exterior circumstances happened and now there's a miscommunication and now we're angry at each other and we have to heal that. Something between that and what we get here, which is just that like no one knows how to do anything properly and everyone's fucked up and they're selfish and narcissistic. And they're only looking after themselves and they're trying to like looking for other people to fix them.
Well, that's life, baby.
Yeah, but I'm looking for something in the middle where characters that are generally, respectable in some dimension and they make mistakes. And then we go through an arc and they learn from their mistakes and they learn that, I did make a mistake. Now I'm going to change. But that doesn't really happen here. It's just everyone is still fucked up at the end.
I think they are fucked up, but I think they do learn that you can't. Like, it's worse to erase the memories than to carry the pain that comes with them. And I think that's the lesson that they learn. Like, Joel is fighting for most of the movie.
Yeah, no, you're right.
To defend that lesson.
He's looking.
That is the lesson.
For happiness as well. I think for me, one of his like completed arcs is when he first goes to the ice, he can't walk on it because what if we fall through and die? Mm-hmm. And then later, maybe hours later, he lays beside her being like, I could die right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's really weird, too. Like, when you're happy, you could die. When you're unhappy, you're afraid of death.
Yeah, because you're missing out.
But if you see that as his, like, arc, then that's not something that he, like, learns and then acts that way forever again. It's a state that he wants to be in.
Mm.
So, at the end of the movie, he's not happy, and he wants to be happy, and she is, like, a vehicle for happiness. So, from that point of view, it makes sense that they'd get back together.
Yeah, because we're just back at the beginning of the movie again, where they get together.
The literal beginning of the movie.
Yeah, it's a big circle, which is, you know, that's fine.
That's part of the appeal of this movie.
Yeah, and I think like that's an authentically human thing. Most people are going to have these toxic relationships that are basically the same one, even though with different people. It's like, unless they're doing the work, they're going to just do the same thing over and over and over.
Can you imagine if they were like, yeah, that tape, I guess we've been through some stuff, hey? Well, that'd be stupid to do again. See ya. Do you have any friends you recommend?
I just, like I said, obviously really the most robotic, autistic, practical thing to do at the end of the movie would be to say,
how dare you?
This did not work. The practical thing is to not get back together. But I think I would have accepted, and obviously that would be a worse movie if that was the ending. But I think I would have accepted like some sort of like explicit statement that, all right, we know that we might not be good for each other. This might not work, but we love each other a lot. So let's really make a go at this. Let's like try to make it better this time.
I feel like this kind of circles around on a big holdup you have often, which is like the moral responsibility of the movie to make it clear what its intention is. And I don't think we've talked about it. So
you've been proven wrong so many times.
I've not been proven wrong once. I will say, I think this movie
makes
a stance on the opposite, where it's like, it's not interested in a moral objectivity. It's just interested in, like you said, describing.
And as that, it certainly succeeds. It's a painting.
Yeah, shout out to her hair color telling the story though. I love it.
Lay it on us.
Yeah, I knew that Edgar Wright, could pick up on something there, but I did not.
So, okay, so she goes from green to red to orange to blue.
Because the first scene she's blue, but...
Yeah, but there's lots to it. I know some analysis I've seen, it's like, you know, green is the color of new life and red is the color of passion. but I think for me, the biggest ones that I really carry forward with me is that she's kind of a more... She's always given the orange hoodie, she's given these warm colors, and he's generally gray and blue and kind of these colder things. And so... When you see her, when she has her blue hair, she's had him erased. And so she still has him like on the mind. She's still thinking of him and she's still like carrying this thing, this want of him. And like when things are like, I think
that's her version of being impulsive and taking the train.
Exactly. And she like the whisper of Joel to her. And I think that's really cool. And I think like her orange hair is like, what did I write? It's just like it's faded, and so she's like lost the steam, and like the way that her roots are exposed in different levels with the different wigs, which I thought it looks so real. I thought
they were wigs
because they shot it all out of sequence because it's a low budget movie, so like she tried to change hair color like 5 times in a day.
Oh jeez, that sucks.
But but the wigs are fantastic. And apparently she kept them. But yeah, so red.
We know she's a kleptomaniac.
Yes.
I just made that up. Sorry, Kate.
No, could be. But then the red is like a full to the root, like this is probably the best dye job, and that's when like things are good and even the memories are positive. It's when he goes back to the 70s, he's a child, and she has like this beautiful red wig and it all works. And it tells a story there, and then it's like, yeah, as the passion fades, it turns to like this orange, but with like her natural color through, and so it's like her authentic self is kind of peeking through in the way that she's like running out of like that original attraction. And so I'm sure there's a bigger analysis we could do, but I think that it's cool that the hair tells the story.
Yeah. There's lots of like little things like that.
I like the, when he goes back and he's a child, I like that when he's surfing through the dreams, even though he has agency, he also is who he is in that memory.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Right. Like who he is in that memory sticks with him and kind of like, it kind of informs what he can do in that memory. And that's nowhere is that more apparent than in the childhood scenes.
Yeah, he's like, when he says, I just want her to pick me up.
I can't believe how strong her compulsion that is. That's amazing.
That's great. Yeah. I think a broad thing that I loved about the movie is seeing Jim Carrey play more of like a straight, awkward character next to Kate Winslet, who generally has played more normal, quote-unquote, characters. Like being the funny person or being like the more outlandish person, you know? I thought that was great. I feel like this was one of the first examples of him trying to do like a more serious dramatic thing.
Yeah, this was really early on because it was just after the golden age of Jim Carrey.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
2005.
Yeah, apparently Michelle...
No, what is it?
The number 23 was in 2007.
Yeah, so Michel Gondry was very acutely aware of the fact that he was working with a big comedian, and apparently he encouraged everyone to improvise and be loose, and he would take Kate Winslet into another room and he'd be like, it's not a drama, it's a comedy, play big. But then he would go to Jim Carrey and be like, it's not a drama, or it's not a comedy, it's a drama.
Right.
Play it small. And so he was very purposeful and like didn't let him improvise, made sure that he played it this awkward kind of like non-impulsive person.
Yeah.
And then allowed everyone else to cut loose. And I think that it works to make Jim Carrey feel so small and depressed.
Yeah.
In a real way.
I think that like it's sad, but I feel like there is an element where it's hard to let go of Jim Carrey, like your conception of Jim Carrey as this like funny guy. So then when he delivers these deadpan lines, a lot of the time I'm like, Jim Carrey's doing an okay job, but at the same time I'm kind of like, I can see him restraining himself and like trying to be like, I'm just a normal guy.
I almost
but I'm
read it the
really
opposite way where like I know that the warm, funny Jim Carrey is on the inside, but there's something diminishing him. There's something right. that like is missing that's allowing him to come out. And like you get the snippets of him being funny, you know, like him putting the pillow on, or him, Kate Winslet putting the pillow on his face, you know, and him being silly.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
There's
and when
moments.
He is silly, he's almost, he goes back to being Jim Carrey, who's really funny. And you're like, it's almost unrealistic because like, how could you be that funny?
Yeah.
What? Right, you can't be a depressive person walking around like that and then be that funny when you're in a good shape.
No.
At the same time, I loved Kate Winslet's like delivery of some of her lines. It was just so like, it's almost like she starts saying the line, you expect her to deliver it one way, and then she kind of like twists something mid delivery. And I was like, oh, okay, nice. Like, hold on, I believe that you're this like unstable extrovert type person.
I just want to go back to what I just said, because I could see people like quoting me and it being like so not true.
It's a big problem.
Like I said, you can't walk around as a depressive person like that and then be that funny. And then I'm thinking like, what about Robin Williams?
No,
like,
you definitely can. That's true.
So that's not necessary. The way to say what I said. Like, I guess the personality that Joel has most of the time, put beside like when he's being his funniest in this movie, just doesn't seem realistic to me.
And that's kind of what I'm
saying.
Talking
about like a comedic giant here. Like,
There's a bit of a fourth wall breaking like instinct where you're like, oh, he's playing a child now, a 4-year old in this memory, and this is the real Jim Carrey.
Yeah, I want ice cream.
Yeah, exactly.
I love him in the sink. And then the transition of them being incinerated or garburated or whatever.
Yeah.
I love
that. That was powerful.
Yeah. And then, oh man, I love the scene when just after that, when they're kids and it's the two actual kid actors and he has to smash the bird and she carries them away and stuff. Apparently how they did it was, I just assumed that it was narrated after, but they had both Kate Winslet and Jim Carrey on scene and they were narrating as the kids were doing the acting. So it kind of like informed each other and it has this weird energy to it.
Yeah, it's like an improv game.
Yeah, but it's a cool scene.
I love what they do where they kind of just like change the way that things are, like they change the, I don't know what you call it, format, vibe, like the production angle. Like they, in one sense, we're watching this, you know, we're watching Joel go through the dreams or whatever. And in the dream world, we'll rapidly switch between, it's like they threw continuity out the window and they're like, it's fine because it's dreaming and it works. In another movie, it would be really annoying that, you know, on the scene where he's like on the ice and he's like screaming at the sky, from the front shot, the light is a lot less. And from the top shot, it's blinding.
Yeah.
And it keeps switching back between those and the lighting is different. But it doesn't bother you because you're like, it's a dream, and it also enhances it.
Yeah.
And that scene, the scene with the kids where they're like, they escape from the bullies or whatever, is another example of that. It just kind of cuts to them as kids, and then we see their voices.
Yeah, because you're like, oh, wait, ADR. I thought we were looking at a 4-year-old... Joel as Jim Carrey, and now we're looking at the 4-year-old Joel as a child actor. What's the difference? What's the deal? But it doesn't matter at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it cuts back to Jim Carrey, but the kids are still kids. And
and then the lights in the ice scene, they're so harsh that you can tell there's just like there's a film spotlight. Right there. But it just totally fits in the movie because we're already just like observing these memories. Yeah. We're not. You know what I mean? Like, they're not the natural environment. We're all kind of like invading these memories together. Yeah, so it works.
I think the movie does a good job transitioning you from objective reality into the subjective reality. When he's back in the office as it's being erased, the lighting has shifted so much from what the real world was. It's like this dark room, and there's just a light on the camera. And so it's really sourcey, and it almost feels like a horror movie, you know, panning around the room.
I loved that motif or whatever.
Like, yeah, there's a lot of like really sourcey lights in it.
Yeah,
it's good.
When they're all the ice scenes, when they're running around, it's like someone just has a flashlight on them. You know, it's like, where's that coming from? It's not the moonlight. No one's pretending.
Yeah.
They're not trying to like act like it's not naturalistic at all in that way.
Right.
But you don't even think about it. It doesn't matter because there's just the dialogue is so realistic and
raw. I thought the whole idea of using the spotlight in the dream sequence, in some of them, was so perfect because, like, in dreams, when you are, like,
there's a point of view camera.
Yeah, the thing that you're paying attention to can sometimes seem really stable, but if you look away and then look back, it could be completely different. And I feel like having them walk through, like, dark rooms and hallways with a spotlight on them and, like, seeing random things playing out in the back, to the side, and then it comes back.
Yeah.
I was like, this is like a dream. This is, like, a really smart idea. Well, and it really, a spotlight.
You can really tell that it feels like they're being sought by the machine or whatever. Like, the machine is seeking them out. And I really like that look.
And that kid scene, though, I really liked when he's like, you know what, Freddy? You don't scare me anymore. And he walks back over. And then, ow, ow, ow! And he just gets bent over. Yeah. That was awesome.
Yeah,
I feel like that might have been a Jim Carrey improvisation.
That was definitely Jim Carrey, for sure.
I think while we're on the look, I think I really appreciate the natural look of the movie outside of the kind of more surreal bits. Like, when you're in the real world, it's dimly lit and it feels like it's all, like, you can see all the sources of light.
You feel the shittiness of the apartment.
Yeah, exactly.
And, like, the oppressiveness of winter. And
even the fact that they chose to do it, it's such a handheld movie. That can often be annoying, but they do it just the right amount where, like, in the dreams, it's, like, really whipping around and swaying and there's, like, more, like, POV-ness to it. But in the real world, it's still a handheld camera, but it's never distracting.
Mm. Well,
I really like how you think you got the movie figured out in terms of, okay, that was like the beginning, but it wasn't actually the beginning, and you understand how all the brain stuff works, and you're flying around for the memories, and you've got it figured out. And then you think the movie's about to be over, and then they do the whole thing where the Kirsten Dunst character, like, mails everyone the tapes, and they do the whole thing with their relationship, like, hearing each other's confessions and stuff.
Yeah.
And that was just like, I didn't see that coming at all, and it's so awesome that it makes you think, this was the whole movie. Like, they thought of, what if that happened, and then reverse engineered the whole Kirsten Dunst character to, like, make that happen.
Well, apparently the whole inspiration for the movie was one of Michel Gondry's, the director's friends, who's an artist, had this idea of sending people just that postcard that they send out of, like, like, Clementine, whatever, has had you erased.
I guess, like, a performance art stunt.
Yeah, exactly. And Gondry was so fascinated by that they kind of, like, started working on it, and eventually they brought Charlie Kaufman in and worked out this idea into a full movie. And it's funny because, like, just that postcard is such an interesting idea of, like, this person's had you erased from their memories. And I was like, oh, well.
And what do you do?
Yeah.
Are you just like, okay, moving on.
Yeah. It's kind of like that the Christmas special episode. It was, like, season 2 of Black Mirror, where that guy gets blocked. It's the one with John Hamm. He gets blocked. His like, ex-girlfriend or whatever blocks him so that he can't, in her vision, he appears as like a blacked out, fuzzy sensor bar.
I don't think that's the John Hamm one, but yeah. I think the John Hamm one is where he's, like, stuck in a...
It's part of the same episode, but it's, like, an hour and a half long episode or something like that.
Is it?
I believe so. But it's John part Hamm of the, it's a Christmas special. It's, like, a big long one.
Okay.
Whatever.
I don't remember.
But that one's so, like, dystopian and, like, and just... Yeah. Oh, eerie. Like, it doesn't matter what I say, what I can come up with. I can't apologize. I'm completely powerless because if I try to speak to this person, all they hear is if I try to wave my arms in front of them, I'm just a smudge.
Yep.
Ugh.
Gross.
Ugh.
Black Mirror. Black when Black Mirror was good.
Yeah.
Oh, dang. Yeah.
Shout out to this movie. Just never stops with, like, new tricks with how they communicate stuff. Like, even when he's first in the chair and he kind of he's having his memory of being in the chair erased, and he's glowing orange. Like, it's like his body, there's, like, this effect of, like, almost like a light leak on his body glowing orange. And it makes sense. He's having, like, Clementine, who's, like, orange, are pulled out from his body, like, pulled away from him. Love that.
Yeah. Okay. One of my last bigger things that I want to say about the movie is basically, like, to go back to my core thing, her problem with it, is the fact that halfway through, I was kind of trying to ask myself the question, is this movie trying to say things about relationships in general, or is it trying to say things about, like, this specific type of fucked up relationship? And I think that, like, I was like, if this is trying to describe, because it did really feel as if Charlie Kaufman or the filmmaker or whoever, the originators of this story, were making this movie sort of as therapy. Like, it's like you go through a breakup, you're wishing that you could forget it and just kind of move on, and, like, oh, it's so painful. And so they make this movie, and it's kind of just like a reflection on relationships and their histories and how they play out, and looking at all the mementos and stuff and remembering things. And I'm like, okay, if it's just like a reflection on a particular relationship and someone made this look as therapy, I have no problem with that. But the main thing that I was trying, like, I was like, is this trying to say things about relationships in general? If so, that bothers me.
I think it is trying to be a universal thing. I don't think it's specific about this relationship.
I think it is too.
But I think that the takeaway, and we've talked about it, is just like you broke up and you have all this pain, but the beauty of the experience is important. Yeah. And like the mistake they make at the end for this tragic ending is that they erase the memories and they try and start again, but like you can't, like you need to carry forward the lessons that you learned in that relationship.
Right. And I'm like down with that. I'm mm-hmm. down with the lesson of you can't just block out parts of your own history and mm-hmm. your relationships. Like it happened. You can't just it like that. It's too easy. You can't look for too easy of a solution to your problems. Mm-hmm. You know, this one doesn't happen to exist in our universe, but I think it's like, it's an interesting goal to let people realize that you got to move on. You gotta, because if you forget where you've been, you're just going to end up there again.
Well, I think that's a real human thing too, where like you forget the people that break up over 3 years, you know, where they break up with someone like, yeah, I'm done with them. And then they like 2 months later, they get back. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. I think they use a particular relationship to show us things that exist in general relationships. Mm-hmm. I think they use this one heightened crazy relationship to show us things that apply to everybody in general. Like, for example, there's always going to be things that memories you want to hold on to, things you want to banish. Mm-hmm. There's certain patterns you're going to go into, but the relationship itself is particular and it's great for a movie too, right? Like the kind of love where like you meet and then on a train and you spend the whole night together and then, can I sleep at your house even though you're going to work? Can I just bring my toothbrush to your house? Like, it's a really intense kind of like young love kind of feel. Yeah.
Even at that point, I was like, what? Wait, why?
But she's nuts though. He's saying what? Wait, why? Right? But he's so like, I don't know. He's been so far from anything like real and exciting that he's like,
for sure.
Okay.
I don't fault them in that moment, which is why it feels really high school-y to me, because it's like, you're doing things that don't really make sense because you're into the person.
But
you know?
I think we touched on it earlier where Joel has had a growth because of that relationship, even if he doesn't have the memories, where he is willing to take chances. Like we see,
even in his childhood, he wants to get picked up by his mom.
Yeah.
And what does she give him? Lots of attention. She wants to be with him.
Yeah.
Go to his house, bring her toothbrush. So he's going to take it.
Right. Please come sleep at my house.
All right.
Nitpicks.
Hit pick David Cross and his wife.
So hilarious.
I forget what their characters' names are, but they're every scene they're in is so great.
I am building a birdhouse. That is so funny. Like, why?
Like, why are you building a birdhouse right there?
But the way he says it, it's like, obviously, if I'm building a birdhouse, are truth.
I have to use
or self-evident.
Yeah.
I think I like that they're an example of not a great relationship too. Like the way they speak to each other is so awful.
Yeah.
But when he's like, you realize that David Cross has kind of hit the point where he's like, there's nothing left to do but tell you what happened. Like tell that she's had her memory erased. But the wife is like reluctant. She's like, no, we talked about this. We're not doing this.
Yeah.
But then she eventually just throws the laundry on him. Love it.
Your laundry.
You do your laundry.
Yeah.
Nice.
But actually you would want, that seems kind of crazy to not tell the ex-boyfriend that the ex-girlfriend erased him. I feel like you'd want to know.
I wonder, I don't know.
Because wait, they sent that card to David Cross and his wife, but not to Joel. Wouldn't they send one to Joel to be like, hey, she's erased you.
You think that, but then you wouldn't have a great movie, I don't think.
But maybe he just hadn't gotten the card yet.
Oh, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah, he doesn't look like the kind of guy to check his mail very
well.
But
the movie acts as if they're like trying not to tell him that
for sure.
She erased him, which was weird.
I don't know why they would do that.
Anyways, that's a nitpick now. It was a hit pick and now it's a nitpick.
I have a hit pick written down. I don't even understand. Just a cut that I really liked, I guess.
That's the best.
It just says, when she asks him to come in, she closes the car door and cut to the apartment.
I had that down.
What am I talking about?
I had that written down too. She's like, do you want to come in? And he's like, no, I better work or whatever.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, he's like, no, I better work. And she's like, oh, yeah, I shouldn't have asked him. But he's like, well, actually, we'll hold on. And then it just cuts to him inside.
No, he doesn't even do that last part. They both just agree no, and it cuts to her being in there. Yeah, like that was awesome.
I thought that was funny.
I thought it was hilarious and very of the time when she like whispers, it's in the scene when he's a baby and she's wearing the 70s outfit and everything, and she's just like, this is kind of warped. Like warped. No one says that anymore. They should though.
And then it's like a weird thing because like he's a kid under the table and she's like, look, my crotch is still here.
Oh,
I was kind of like,
and he's like, but, yuck.
Yeah. Yeah, that was great.
I like when early on in the movie, and it comes back a couple times, he's walking across the street with his memories of Clem, and the truck almost hits him, and the guy's like, wake up, buddy.
Yeah.
And I was like,
my other one. You guys are taking my hit picks.
The only thing I have remaining is one nitpick, actually, which is the whole forced perspective thing to make him look small in that big kitchen. It's all great until Clem gets under the table with him, and then they're both just the same size.
No, but that's fine. I think like that's the kind of the point is when she's like breaking the memory, then she can be the same size.
Okay, okay.
That dream logic worked for me. Well, the other thing
is that he was in the foreground, so if you're trying to make her look bigger, then she should be in the foreground. But yeah,
I think it mostly works, and it's certainly a very fun scene. Do you guys know that they basically never stopped shooting on these film sets? Apparently Michel Gondry was just like, keep shooting, even when they were kind of in between takes, and he got like these weird authentic takes from people. Like Mark Ruffalo told the story where they would just be like hanging out, and then he would look around and realize that there's a bunch of cameras pointed at them, and they're like,
hello.
And so they shot 36,000 feet of film each day, and film is very expensive even when it was more prominent. And that's about 6 hours and 40 minutes every day of film rolling.
Ugh.
Wow. It'd be so obnoxious to have a film camera pointed at you.
I can't, and you're saying they used some of those?
I don't know, 100%.
Probably not much.
They cut a lot of stuff. Like, there was scenes with Naomi, like Joel's ex. There was scenes with her that they cut because they just didn't have time for it. But apparently Kaufman was fighting for them very hard.
It's weird that she's not in the movie at all.
Who? But,
his ex-girlfriend that he mentions a bunch of times, the woman he was living with.
Yeah, I feel like...
Totally works without her.
Yeah, we can imagine what they were like.
They cut a sex scene. They cut the sex scene between Mark Ruffalo and Kristen Dunst. Apparently they shot it, but...
Oh.
Didn't need it.
Doesn't add anything.
Yeah, we did not need that. What the hell was that with that with the... Ba-da-ba-doo?
Social justice. He says the words. 2004, baby.
Does he?
Yeah.
I was going to say, what was that pretending to kill each other with a pillow thing? I didn't understand that.
Just it's being a fun weird game. Together.
They're being weird, but like she puts the pillow on his head and then she brings it up and he's like pretending to be dead. And she's like, oh no, are you okay? And then he wakes up and she's like, that wasn't even that good. Let's do it again. And then it's implied that he's going to switch
turn.
And then he's going to go. And I'm like, what?
You don't do weird things.
What is the objective of the game?
And Lauren probably play really weird games.
I mean,
you got idiosyncrasies,
but
you got memes.
I don't understand what they're doing.
Don't try to understand it. It's just love. Just wild, crazy love.
But like, there was obviously an objective. Like, how long can you
have
pretend to be dead?
Have we seen Howard's wife before? I'm moving on.
I hate when you do this.
I hate when you do this.
What was the objective?
We don't know. It doesn't matter.
It's just fun.
We already told you our answers.
All right. I'll allow it.
Have we seen Howard's wife before? She seems vaguely familiar when she shows up. Like, did they show her in an earlier scene? Like, you see her beside Howard when the phone, he answers the phone in the middle of the night, and she looks kind of suspicious. But before that, have we ever seen her?
No.
All right, maybe not.
Hit pick to how disgusting that storyline makes me feel when you realize that he had erased her memory and, like, still allowed it to happen. That was, like, it made me so mad.
Yeah.
You can see, because you're, like... He's the good guy for a while there.
You
can see him just like glancing off. He's like, oh, this poor girl, leave me alone kind of thing. And then he kisses her.
He makes a very, pathetic attempt to kind of like stave it off a little bit. And he's like, Mary, we can't do this. It's not good.
Power of redheads.
I love Mark Ruffalo in this movie.
She's Mary Jane Watson. Yeah,
that's a real name.
That's a real name.
And then this guy was in Batman. He's Carmine Falcone in Batman Begins.
Oh wow!
I love Mark Ruffalo's look. He's got like the faux hawk and
I loved his hair actually. It's awesome.
I've seen a whole lot of early Mark Ruffalo movies. I think I've only really seen him as like the middle aged guy.
I just watched 13 Going on 30, so he was very young in that.
No. I have seen that, and he's great in it, too.
It's not even a faux hawk. It's like a wide, grown-out mohawk.
Yeah.
It's cool.
I like his, I mean, I believed that he was this character. This kind of like, oh, I'm kind of like a stoner pizza hacker computer guy, dude.
Yeah.
That's what they sound
yeah,
like.
Yeah, yeah.
I will say that it annoys me a little bit how irresponsible they are. Like what, I feel like it's so obnoxious how little they care about their work.
I think
like,
it's just the job was so easy. It's like prison guards like watching movies on night shift.
That's
like
right.
They all do it because you don't have to work for like every 40 minutes. You have to do a check or something like that. So it's,
it did like reduce my immersion.
You know, if something goes crazy, like Epstein tries to kill himself or something.
It did like reduce my immersion a little bit though, because I'm like, okay, this is a futuristic technology. I mean, like we don't see in any other aspect of the world that things are like futuristic. So we have the, like suddenly there's this futuristic technology, and instead of being like, and it's widely available, anyone can just walk in and people know about it. And
well, it's not that wide. Like, you know, Jim Carrey's character says that's not a thing. You can't do that.
Yeah, I guess so. But then there's a clinic and, you know, there's other people waiting in there. It's not like it's like, ooh, it's highly secretive.
I think if they tried to make it like a far future thing, like the original script was, it would just be like, it would just be distracting, and it doesn't serve the story.
Well, no, because it has to be kind of secretive. Otherwise, if you live in a world where everyone's doing it, you take a lot of the cachet out of the movie.
True.
Yeah, I guess so. But I guess that the fact that it is a secretive thing and it's implied to be kind of a futuristic tech that not many people know about, it should be exciting, you know? And instead we get like engineers who are kind of just like not flippant, taking it seriously. And I was kind of like, this wouldn't be the case.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing with tech, though. A few people understand how it works and can design it, and then everyone else is supposed to just use it, know nothing about it. So I think it's just, it's kind of like that. Like, all right, you went to a technical college for 2 years. You know enough programming. You can sit in front of this terminal, and here's what you do. When you see, it's kind of like in Severance, where like they sit in front of those terminals, and all they have to do is like, yeah, well, if you feel weird, you hit the button on that number. They don't have to really know what the numbers are.
Well, I feel like that's like a Severance specific thing.
I think that, but I think the movie tries to say that Mark Ruffalo's character is a good technician. Like he knows, he's smart, and he's
And I think this is something.
But
that
it's also an
me.
Easy job.
That's fair.
It is.
Normally it's autopilot. For him.
But I think this is something specifically that bothers me in movies when there's like a highly advanced technology and someone's doing it, but the technician doing the technology is like, eh, whatever, man, it's still like whatever, we do this all the time and it's like totally chill. And I feel like for a technology like this, there should be more of a sense of like, we can actually erase your memories. You know? Yeah. And it makes, you know, it gives opportunities to have these funny moments with the beer and the pizza and whatnot. But
everything gets like that when you've done it a lot, though.
Sure, but not to the audience. I don't know.
I didn't mind it.
I can see it both ways.
I don't know why I hit. Yeah.
I got nothing else for this.
I'm done.
Got some now playing.
As a lark, what does that mean? Okay, let's do that. Okay, what are y'all watching?
I have so many. It's been a while.
I didn't finish Rings of Power, so we can't talk about that
next week.
We screwed up the promise of like giving a review of Rings of Power.
I finished it.
You did?
Yeah.
I have not either. And I have both not finished it.
Very curious to see what you guys think.
My friend was like, there's spoilers everywhere. Watch out on the internet.
Yeah.
I feel like the discussion kind of faded away pretty quick on that show. Like, it's not like House of Dragon. I feel like I've seen memes.
A lot
of people
more
talking.
People are bringing up House of the Dragon. Yeah,
whereas Rings of Power sort of faded away. Mm-hmm. I haven't watched House of Dragons yet. So
I heard that the ending of Rings of Power is slightly lackluster.
It's someone in my DILF's group chat last night was like, if you're having trouble sleeping, put on the newest episode of House of the Dragon.
Oh yeah, that makes sense. Oh, I was talking about Rings of Power, but
yeah,
House of Dragon.
I
got bored
halfway through the sentence.
I got bored and clicked out of that in the first episode.
House of Dragons?
Yeah.
Not enough space lasers.
Not enough boobs.
Not enough. Isn't there boobs in that show?
I'm sure there is.
There's gotta be.
Probably incest boobs.
Horse boobs. Horse
something boobs. That I'm watching that I wanted to briefly mention that I've mentioned before is Andor.
Nice.
And I've said that it's good. I'm up to date with it now. But there was a post on the r/saltier than crate subreddit, which I'm subscribed to.
That's
salty.
Right.
Salty Star Wars fans are upset about Disney. And somebody tweeted audience numbers for the show, and they're like, Andor is the... Wait, what's the tweet? I got it here. Andor is the most disappointing trend I've come across recently is how audience demand for Andor is overwhelmingly lower than The Mandalorian Season 1 to 2,
oof,
The Book of Boba Fett, and Obi-Wan, despite the fact that it is easily the best Star Wars series by far. And
fatigue.
Like, it seems like... I don't think I've seen anyone claiming that... like Obi-Wan or Mandalorian or whatever is better than Andor. I think it's like everyone is understanding that it's the best of the Star Wars TV shows, and at the same time, it's one of the least watched.
Well, yeah, and it's fool me once, shame on me.
Yeah.
Like, because when Mandalorian came out, that was like the first Disney Star Wars show.
Yeah.
So I was like, gotta see what that's going to be like. And then that was a disappointment. And then when Obi-Wan came out, I was like, okay, I'm back for another chance because it's Obi-Wan.
Yeah, McGregor's back.
You gotta check that out. And it was what it was. So then you're like, well, okay.
Andor was a hard sell. You're like, remember that guy in that sort of prequel movie? They did a whole TV show on him.
Yeah, I thought it was such a strange decision for them to put so many resources into this show, but they did, and it's a really good show.
Maybe what
and
happened is like there's fewer executives putting their finger on the scale, and that's why it's good. They just let the filmmakers do their jobs.
Well, and also it's not Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau, who are fine, you know, like I don't hate them, but like I think after seeing a ton of their content, I'm just kind of like, okay, I'm kind of over it. But this is the same guy. It's the Gilroy brothers, Dan Gilroy and the other guy.
You always got to have a brothers
who did Rogue brothership. One, and they're like they have other people directing and stuff, but they're writing it and show running it together. And the top comment on this Reddit post is, well, the reason no one's watching it is because everyone who cares about quality has stopped watching Star Wars.
Yes.
And I was just like, oh, it hurts. But it's true.
I also think that a big part of the people that watch Star Wars are only interested in the spectacle. And they want the big boy.
I tweeted about it and someone replied just saying, didn't look interesting to me. I want Jedi and Sith.
Ew.
I'm like, you're the problem.
Yeah. I plan on watching it, but I'm like, I'm going to watch it in a couple days. You know, I'll just put it on. So I'm going to wait for it all to be done.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Speaking of shows that are
being watched by you,
being watched by me, I finished She-Hulk.
Mm.
It's pretty good. There's some good episodes in there. The ending's kind of weird. They do a weird meta thing. Spoilers for She-Hulk. You guys.
I actually pressed play on it. I was like, you know what? I'm going to check out the first episode. I pressed play on it yesterday with the Marvel, like, thing at the beginning.
Yeah.
Hadn't even, like, the sizzle reel thing, hadn't even finished. My kid was like, this isn't a cartoon. I want a kid show. And I was like, not today. It's not happening, I guess.
Sorry.
Yeah, they do, I won't spoil it then. They do a meta thing in the final episode that I think is kind of fun, but it really undercuts the drama of it in a way I think that cerebrally I enjoyed, but my emotional impact was just like, my emotional investment was just sucked out of the room.
Yeah, I saw a article headline saying She-Hulk has succeeded by being the most MCU thing ever. And I was like, yeah. But I think I've watched, is it two or three episodes? I've watched something like that. And I think I was like, this is fine, but it just didn't really like compel me to continue watching.
It hits its stride, like every TV show, it hits its strides a little later in once they've done the introduction work and stuff, and there's just fun stuff. Like there's some good fan servicey stuff where I was like, nice, this is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
But it's not amazing. You'll know if you want to watch it. I wouldn't highly recommend it, but if you're like mildly interested, it's worth putting a couple
of episodes on. It's crazy they can even use that name of a show. Hey, She-Hulk, woman version.
Yeah.
Well, that's the character's name.
I know.
Well, it was funny.
It's woman version of man.
Well, it's speaking to that, so derivative. It's kind of funny. Cassie's playing Dragon Quest, and there's like a Hulk looking person. They have like, you know, armor. They're all green. And Zoe, her kid, walks in, and she's like, oh, it's like a man She-Hulk.
It's like He-Hulk.
It's She-Hulk.
Like, you mean the Hulk?
Absolutely.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
That restores my faith in humanity.
Hey. I also watched Hocus Pocus 2.
Oh, that came out. Hey,
man. Yeah, it's all right. If you like the first one, it's worth watching. It's about the same quality as the first one, which is not a good thing.
Hocus Pocuser. That's what it should have been called.
Lord was asking about, she saw all this stuff for Hocus Pocus 2, and she's like, let's just like throw that on. I don't know. I've never seen it. I'm like, I haven't either. So we threw it on. We watched like half of it. And I'm like, this is a weird movie.
Like tonally?
Yeah. It's weird because they're like kooky witches, and they're wacky and weird, and they're funny. They are funny. I enjoy them.
It's a movie your auntie takes
you to. But they're also the antagonists, and they're trying to eat children.
Yes.
And so the whole movie, you're kind of like, what's going on here? Like,
who am I rooting for?
Yeah, is this funny? Is it horrifying?
They sort of struggle with that to bring it home, because clearly those three women are the stars of the show. Like, that's the reason why the sequel exists, because everyone loves them. But they're vile witches. And so the movie tries to play it both ways, and the ending is a very witch-positive ending.
Oh, yeah.
And it's good if you can turn off the part of your brain that remembers that they ate children. But yeah, it's fun. And it's fun in the same way that the first one was, where it's campy, stupid teenage stuff mixed with fun, kooky witch stuff. And it works. But it's, if you like the first one, you like this. If you have no interest in the first one, don't bother.
Hey, didn't you go to like Disney World or something?
I sure did.
In Florida?
In Orlando. Orlando.
Is that their theme song?
No, that's from Book of Mormon.
That's what it says on the license plates.
Orlando with the notes.
There's a little button you can press.
My review of Orlando is, it's a 1 out of 10. Orlando is the biggest hole on this fucking planet.
Damn.
Went to Universal Studios.
Florida
first.
Man kills David.
Went to Universal Studios. It's all right. Some good rides. I walked through Harry Potter World. It sucks. It's not nearly as good as people say it was. Don't go. Save your money.
Mm-hmm. So just too many muggles.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you walk in and the first impact's kind of cool. You're like, oh, that's neat. But then it's just stores with kind of normal merch. And it's like the illusion is very quickly broken and it kind of just sucks.
Right.
My review of Disney World is fucking 10 out of 10.
Oh, dang.
Disney World is insane.
Chill?
It's insane how much work goes into that park. Like the amount of detail in every corner. Like you go behind a building, there's like everything is just like flavor. And it feels like you're absolutely transported into this world. The rides are all really fun. Obviously, it's not as thrilling as Universal. There's more roller coasters, kind of bigger rides at Universal. But Disney World, they commit to creating this illusion. Like the two best rides are the Star Wars one and the Avatar one. One of the Avatar ones is,
Abana.
Is you the line is, you're inside the military base, like the human military base, and then they play videos as you go in, and then you get a briefing being like, we need you to be an avatar.
Abana.
And they give you a gun, and then you just mow down.
Well, like you go and you stand on these circles, and they're like, okay, stand on these pressure plates, we're gonna get your info, and then they like we need your biology, and they blow on air on you, and they do this full illusion of like connecting you to the avatar.
Abana.
And they're like, okay, we're gonna put you in the like symbiosis chair or whatever it is, and that's gonna connect you to your avatar. So you go and it takes like a video of you and it's playing
right up your butt.
And it like morphs your face onto it. Anyways, and then
your own face?
Yeah, like, your own face onto the thing.
Oh.
And it pairs you to like an avatar, but it's like it doesn't look like you, but it's just like it pretends like it is. But the illusion is there. But then all of a sudden the room you're in opens up and it's like this 50-foot screen like 4 feet away from you in this 3D, and you're just all of a sudden fucking flying through Pandora. Whoa. And it's like, it's wild. The illusion is there. They're blowing air on you. And I haven't had the illusion of flight like that in my entire life.
Are you in a chair at this point?
You're in a motorcycle thing, and it's like, it's supposed to be like the symbiosis chair that connects you mentally to the avatar. And like it.
And then you're flying on one of those dragon things.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like this whole ride. And it's like, it's 7-8 minutes. No, maybe like 5 minutes of actual ride. It feels like a long time compared to a lot of the other ones. Absolutely thrilling. Like you come out of it, you're just like, you feel so alive. Man. It's wild. It's I had never experienced a ride
such
like
immersion.
That. Yeah.
Wow.
And that was my second favorite ride. My favorite ride, as much as I hate Star Wars, is the fucking Star Wars experience. It is the Rebellion one. I can't remember. There's a lineup. We went right Resistance. First thing in the morning. Rise of the Resistance.
Yeah.
Rebellion.
Don't say Rebellion. It's the Resistance. They're completely different.
But it's the lineup first thing in the morning is for both these rides, it's like 2-3 hours.
Cool.
There's ways to get around it. You don't have to do it. And they always overestimate the waits. But anyways, this one, you go and you're waiting in line and you're walking through kind of like tunnels, like the Star Wars Rebel tunnels or whatever. And you can see how it's been like dug out and it's really cool. And eventually, before you know it, you're kind of put into a room with other people. And then all of a sudden BB-8 comes out and he's like talking to you. And you're like, okay. And then there's like a hologram pad with Rey.
So there's no clear distinction between lineup and ride has begun.
No, I didn't know that we were like in the experience, but people were just like, oh yeah, into here. And then they close the doors. And then like you're in a room with people instead of in a line. And then it's just like, it starts. They give you like, oh, you're on the Resistance. You got to help us do these things. They walk you to a ship. The ship takes off. And like you're in a little dogfight trying to survive, and then you get captured by the First Order. That, and then the ship opens up, and then you're inside a Star Destroyer, and you open up, and you can see space, and there's like 100 stormtroopers, and there's like, it's just this huge room, and you're like, okay, shit, and they're like, all right, we're gonna interrogate you. And you walk over.
So are you physically in a huge room?
You're physically in this huge room, and you're like, this is so fucking cool.
You're like on the set.
Yeah, and it's huge.
But then there's screens that look like space and stuff.
Yeah, and like there's stuff going by, and the stormtroopers are all. Like, some of them are animatronics, some of them are just, like, it's not people.
Are there any people?
There are some people around. There's, like, the person that first greets you outside of the ship is an officer, and they're like, you've been captured, go over there for interrogation. Then you go wait in line for the next experience. And then you go into the interrogation room, where Kylo Ren, there's like a whole experience with a bunch of people, but you actually go into a room. And what's great about this ride is you're
right walking, up your butt again.
You're actually going through these spaces, and then you're put in the interrogation room, and you're put in the chair. Or no, you're there, and then all of a sudden there's like a laser bolt going through, like the laser cutter opening through the wall, and then the wall falls open.
Oh no!
And they're like, "Come with us!" Like the resistance.
It really falls.
It pulls out.
Like a physical piece of a wall
goes like. Phoom.
Okay.
And then the guy's like, "Come on!" And then you get in the chairs and
real human is like dressed up. It's like, "Come on!" Really,
come on! And then there's an R5 droid on a little thing, and they're like, "R5's gonna get you out of here." R5's, and you sit down, you get locked in, and then all of a sudden you're going through the ship, and it's like these huge cavernous rooms and these hallways, and you're going through, and then all of a sudden there's stormtroopers like shooting at you.
Whoa!
And they do this crazy light projection thing where it looks like the metal is being shot off. And it's so immersive. And I have an active distaste for Star Wars. And all of a sudden, the magic was so fucking real.
Imagine you were on acid. Holy shit.
I bought so much merch.
I wish I was so high. I would have been so. But anyways, I don't want to spoil too much. But
you either have to be a child or high. They're kind of the same.
Yeah.
Everyone in the ride is just kind of like, "Whoa, cool." And he's just like,
I've probably given away too much. I would highly recommend both of those rides. Disney World is definitely worth the money. If I ever go to Orlando again, I'll get off the plane, take a shuttle to Disney World, spend all my time there, shuttle back to the airport. Don't see anything else. It is a horrible, miserable city.
Dang, dude.
But Disney World is fucking awesome.
Are you stoked out of your mind for Avatar 2?
Abana.
I was definitely more excited because in that Pandora one, they do a bunch of they've created creatures, world building, all that stuff. And it's like you're like flying over it and seeing all these different parts of the planet. You're like, yeah, this is pretty cool. Super cool.
Did they show the because in the new one they have the dragon flying things, but they're in the water too.
Those are called fish.
Yeah.
They didn't show you fly over the water and they spray water on you, whatever. Like it's like there's like the giant megalodons that come out or whatever.
They got megalodons?
Whatever they're called.
That I have to just take a moment to talk about the Abinar thing because I had a friend who had not seen it. This is just in the last week.
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh, you haven't seen how Schwarzenegger does it?" I think it might have been my wife. And I showed her. And the thing that's so dope about it is he's reading from a teleprompter and he says Abinar like 5 different times. So it's not a slip up. He sees it's just a peculiarity of his accent. Yeah. He sees those letters and that's how he does it.
Abinar.
It's like, Abinar. It's repeatable. It's a repeatable bug. It's so funny.
I love it. He's a national treasure.
Internationally.
Of Austria.
But yeah.
Cool. Thanks, David.
It's fucking so cool. I could go on for a long time, but I won't.
Did we decide what we're doing next week? I forget.
Yeah, we did. Train to Busan.
Oh, train to Busan.
Oh,
yeah. Busan? Busan?
What are we, Americans?
What is it?
Busan.
Train to Busan.
Well, train is a French word, so it should be train
de Busan.
I'm sure that's how they pronounce it in the movie.
Train du poisson.
See you later. You can tweet at us at TJMPod. You can email us hello@theyrejustmovies.com. Might take me a couple months, but I'll give you a one-word reply at some point.
And it means everything. Love you.
Bye.